Hello and welcome to the Dahlgren Centennial Celebration, a century of innovation. We hope this and our many other products, events, and offerings will showcase what Dahlgren has accomplished during its last 100 years. Throughout our history, we have interviewed some of the most prominent minds, leaders, and innovators that have been here, and we're opening up the vault to share them with you this year. Today, we are honored to listen to the story of Charles Roble, an engineer at Dahlgren from 1941 to 1967. Mr. Roble started on base as a battery attendant, but eventually joined the professional staff and retired as a supervising electronics engineer. Much of his interview covers what it was like to work on the base during and after World War II. Let's listen to Mr. Roble.
This is Jamie Rife, and I am speaking with Mr. Charles Roble by way of phone on Tuesday, 29th July, 2003. I'm in my Dahlgren office, and Mr. Roble is at home in California. Mr. Roble, my first question is, could you please give me a brief resume or rundown of your career at Dahlgren from 1941 to 1967? You don't have to go into too much detail, but just generally how you progressed going from labor all the way up to working in the velocity section.
Well, let's just take the ratings, if you want to call them that.
Sure.
I was hired on as a laborer on February 24th, 1941. And after the schooling that they send you, which is noted in that excerpt, then they rate you whatever they feel like you're best suited for. And they rated me battery attendant, which means you should handle ammunition and guns and whatever, which made me very unhappy.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I put it in the excerpt or not, but after that five-week period and they sent me back to main range, I wouldn't take my tag off because I didn't like the idea of working with guns.
Well, there's a certain level of danger involved in it.
Right, well, it's bang, 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 you know. Well, anyway, I ended up working around them all the time anyway, but I didn't have to work with them. So that battery attendant just didn't apply to where they actually put me, which was over in the velocity section. There were just two men in there when I went in, and that would have been 5 weeks after the 24th of February, whatever that would be. Mr. Bundick was in charge, and Dick Thompson was his subordinate, and we won't go into the details of how things worked out personnel-wise, except for the fact that within 5 minutes, Mr. Bundick and I were just like we'd known each other all our life. He grasped pretty quick that I could catch on to things, so that was important. And it also was very important was that in 1943, they closed down the base housing to single men. As a result of that, he went to see the ordnance officer, asked him to apply it to him, and he says, "Are you married?" and he told him, said, you know that my wife died 2 years ago. He said, "Well, that means you." He said, "Okay, I'll be retired in 3 days," which he did. And he then insured my job. And that doesn't sound so easy, but he was, at that time, the only man on the base that was allowed to design and construct the control board firing a gun. And he gave me all the information, the formulas, and so forth and so on. And I started to write things down. "Don't you dare," he says. "Keep it between your ears. That's why they're not going to get rid of you." And what I couldn't believe, before we got out of there, he'd got permission from the Bureau for me to be in charge of that. Here I was, a battery attendant. It wasn't until 44 that I made a change in rating. That was a sub-professional engineering aide, and that was in May of 44. Then the next step was in October of 49. They're kind of far between on to the GS-6 engineering aide, and then March of 52, a GS-7 engineering aide, and in December of 54, supervisor engineering aide, GS-8. And all this time, I had been fighting to get into the professional levels as an engineer. And I had people from groups come down from Civil Service Commission, sit down and talk for hours and say, "No, no, 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 no." And then on March of 57, I was lucky enough to be allowed to take the engineer equivalency exam. I passed that fine. So the funny part about it was that I had sent in a resume of my experiences, and personnel had said insufficient. But then after passing the professional engineer's exam, they reevaluated the same information. All of a sudden, I was eligible for engineering level, so they started me as a GS-9 engineering technician, and that was on May of 57. And then in February of 58, I was changed then to supervisor electronic engineer, GS-9, and then in June of 59, GS-11, supervisor electronic engineer. December of 59, GS-12, supervised electronic engineer, and in July of 63, GS-13, supervised electronic engineer.
Did you ever take any college classes?
I took a number of classes on the base, I took physics and statistics. Well, I enjoyed the whole bit of it, really. The only thing I didn't enjoy was the fighting with Mr. Thompson. But in February of 1958, they had a reorganization.
Became the Weapons Lab.
And they took me from out of Thompson's bailiwick and to work for his son-in-law, Bill Secor. And that was the comparatively speaking, a real pleasure. That's it as far as, you know, what happened when.
Right. And you left Dahlgren in 1967. Did you retire at that point, or did you move?
Well, after you get to 11 or above, they require you to take a physical by naval doctors every 2 years. And in 1966, in that physical, I hadn't had one since 64, they called me in to the head surgeon over there and said, you had 3 massive heart attacks since the last jam that we had. So we're going to put you off on 90 days leave. And at the end of that 90 days, you come back in and we'll run these tests again and then we'll evaluate how you're doing. And they did that and they said, well, we're really happy with your advance and so forth and so on. And we'll let you go back to work next Monday. However, here are the 10 rules that you must abide by. So anyway, I took them to the department head and he said, fine. They put me in a glass enclosed office and put out orders, nobody to bother me unless I was the only one could answer the question. And that worked fine Monday and Tuesday. And Wednesday night, about midnight, my boss dropped dead, Bill Secor. And so by the end of the following week, whereas I was just the head of a section, he was the branch head, which was 3 sections. And whenever he was on vacation or anything like that, I was acting branch head. And that was too much, so they let me finish a job that I was doing at that particular time, writing a proposal, and then out the door.
Anyway, my next question is, and you may have the answer to this or maybe not, but during World War II, and this is drawn from a chapter that we have already completed, but later on I'm going to go back and revise it. And one of the things that was going on at sort of at the upper levels at Dahlgren during World War II was this conflict between the military guys and the civilian scientific and other civilian blue-collar employees.
It was not only in that vein, but also the fact that the way things were set up, the lowest naval person could order any civilian at whatever level. And that was very irritating. I mean, I don't remember too many details on that because I wasn't high enough that to bother me. Only thing is that sometimes they'd get a little miffed and you'd have a terrible time even getting in the gate.
My next question concerns that, and I think you already answered this in an email that we exchanged last week, but it concerns Captain Hedrick. He was the commanding officer at Dahlgren from April 1941 until June 1946. And by the accounts that we have on hand, he was quite an odd duck. He was a good military builder, and he apparently ran Dahlgren fairly efficiently, but he did not really like the scientists. I was wondering, did he ever come down to where you were working, and did you ever get to meet Captain Hedrick?
No, I heard the statements and whatever by some of the people higher than me. They almost hated him, but
right.
I had no personal dealings with him whatsoever.
Okay. Well, that confirms a lot that we've found, especially in some of the works we had on Deke Parsons, because Parsons had essentially served as a liaison between the civilian scientist and Hedrick. So it put him into a very uncomfortable situation, had to deal with Hedrick.
Now, I don't know if this fills in for you now, but I noticed in my personnel folder different certificates and whatever and who they were signed by. Like August of 58, there was a certificate, I can't remember what it was for now, but it was signed by the deputy commander of the Naval Proving Ground, and the best I can make out, his name was probably C.R. Faust, F-A-U-S-T.
Faust. He later, let's see, he, yeah, actually...
And then in December 59, I got an outstanding performance signed mm-hmm. by the same guy as the commander.
Yeah, exactly. He must have got promoted, because I'm looking at my list of commanders at Dahlgren, Captain A.R. Faust, September 1959 through March 1960. So apparently he was under Captain Simmons, and then when Simmons left in August 1959, Captain Faust was promoted in his place. So
I don't have that name at all, because it's the only thing I have on it.
Sure.
It was something that pertained to me.
Exactly.
And
so.
August of 62 through November 64, I have different things signed by Sellers.
Yep, Captain R.F. Sellers.
Okay. Then, 65, I have an award that's signed by W.A. Haskbaser.
And he was base commander until July 1968.
Okay. So. That's all of that kind of
yeah. Thing. Yeah, we've got actually on Dahlgren down in the administration building, they've got a roll of commanding officers. As well.
Oh, yeah?
And it's pretty detailed. What we did at the beginning of the project was go down and copy it all down. And we've been using that as a guide to, you know, let us know who's in charge of the base at any particular time. Stuff. I got another question for you. Are you familiar with the term watermen?
Watermen?
Yes.
Out on the river.
Who are they? What do they do?
Oyster. Mostly.
The oystermen.
pushed them.
Ah, so they were not really affiliated with the base.
No. In fact, the family that I lived with at Colonial Beach were watermen.
Oh, okay.
William J. Stanford family.
Yeah. Okay. Because when we had our first meetings with the current commander of Dogburns, Captain Lyle Davidson, he had alluded to the watermen, and we have sort of scratched our heads up to now because we haven't found anything on watermen. We were wondering who they were. So
I imagine it was sometimes a new skin in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, and have to run them out of the range.
Well, for one thing, that happened very often, of course, when these guys are hoisting with dredges, they would dredge up projectiles and stuff. Some of those were very dangerous.
Sure.
I know somebody pulled up one and gave it to a guy that was like a caretaker for the power company, and he was going to convert it into something, and it blew up, killed him, and tore the building down.
Well, those are pretty powerful, and I guess there's a lot of ordnance still laying on the bottom of the Potomac.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the mud, you know, is about 8 or 10 feet thick.
Sure. Another question I have is, it concerns a billboard, and I haven't been able to find anything on this so far. Maybe you can help me. But there, at some point in the past, someone had set up a billboard that read, "Don't mind our noise, it's the sound of freedom." Do you know anything about it? Who put it up and when?
No, the only thing that I would know about a field board is that after they gave me permission to design and construct the firing control panels, I made a portable model. So when they fired guns in the field, they would have all the safety stuff, you know, they can test the primers. And before that time, they didn't have. They just had it almost hit and miss it.
Yeah, well, this thing was a big sign, like a current advertising billboard. And it had apparently been put up as a result of complaints about the noise from the gunfiring. And someone had put this up to basically say, "Hey, listen, we're making this noise in order to protect your freedom." And that is something also that the current base commander passed along to us, but I haven't been able to find any information on it. And I was hoping that you could remember it. It might come later in the 70s. It's entirely possible.
Well, so. I can understand the people complaining about gunfire because my mother lived over at Colonial Beach on Cedar Avenue, and when they shoot that 16-inch, boy, their whole house would rock.
Sure, yeah. It's really, I mean, 2,000, well, I guess as big as a Volkswagen, a shell. They still have at Dahlgren. I don't think they shoot them anymore. Most of what they're shooting now is really 5-inch and less, maybe 5-inch and 3-inch. I've heard the guns go off several times when I've been down there, but what they've done, they set up displays with, there's an 18-inch projectile, there's a 16-inch projectile all the way down through the major calibers. Mm. And you can walk up to the back of the main battery now, and they also have the old range, I guess a range map showing the distances and head curves. That sort of brass or...
Oh, that was in 218 building.
Yeah.
It was still in 218 when I left.
They got it out in the open now. You can walk up and look at it.
Ah.
So, 218...
And they're not using that for ranging anymore?
No, they're not. They're not. It just, I guess everything's done by computers now.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And building 218 is now the technical library. And it has a wing. It's now for G Department, which G Department was formed in 1968, the year after you left.
Yeah.
And that's currently where they do a lot of their Buck Rogers hardware research. I met with the head of G Department, Tommy Churn, I guess about a month ago, and it's also where they used to have their computers, the NORC as well as the Aiken computers.
Well, you were saying something about the Naval Proving Ground being, say, reestablished or renamed or whatever.
Yeah, it became the Naval Weapons Laboratory in 1959.
And I think that really there are several things that made that have to be. One, of course, is the computer facility. And second thing was the programs that we were getting into, the GE Mark III ICBM fusing system and the Sidewinder and the special weapons.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I think I have that on your write-up that I sent you.
Yeah, it was in the excerpts, but actually that elaborates on that a little bit.
Well, see, my problem is my book stopped in 48, and I had to really get my personnel folder out to remind me of stuff after that.
What about the Korean War? How did the Korean War affect? Do you remember anything about how proof and testing?
One of the things that I am reminded of in the Korean War is that was the first that I know of that they used jet planes, and they were being shot down too often. Well, they came to Dahlgren to have them run tests, find out what was going on, and of course it proved out that the jet planes kept going faster than the bullets after they shot them because of the air whatever holding them back, and they were shooting themselves down.
So the air resistance, they were shooting themselves down because the air resistance...
Right.
They were essentially running to their own bullets.
Right.
Oh, well, that's interesting. That's definitely useful.
And that was quite a test setup to say, to simulate it. And the only thing I had to do with it was out over the riverbank and down behind the bank, under the bank, where the gun could. What they did, they actually put a 20-millimeter barrel inside of an 8-inch projectile and fired at it 0 degrees, and I was to catch each one of the projectiles as it went by.
Hmm, you write that down. What else? How heavy was the testing during the Korean War? Did it pick up during that time? Was there more testing than you would say in the immediate period after World War II, or about the same? Or
you mean the number of guns fired?
Yeah, the number of guns fired.
Well, I think it tapered off quite a bit. In fact, I can't remember exactly what year, but starting along in the area of maybe 48 or 49, there was all kinds of kids floating around by closing the base down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I found a newspaper account from 1953, immediately after the Korean War, which there was concern in the community that Dahlgren was, in fact, going to be closed. And this is one of the things that led to the change from being a proving ground to a Navy weapons lab,
mm-hmm.
in that the people in charge had to find a new mission other than proof and test, because the idea being that guns were obsolete.
Another thing that's very important to the Navy that was developed at Dahlgren, I can't tell you when or whatever, but I have an idea, it was probably in the late 60s, was the Aegis program. Of course, that was primarily computer facility work.
Yeah, that actually, I think that program started in 1968, and
I figured it was after I left, because I remember I used to get the Dahlgren logs. I don't know whether they don't print it anymore or they don't send it to me.
It's now called the Bullet, actually. They changed the name of it. It's now the Bullet, and I think they're in the process of changing it again. They brought in a new naval reservist.
Whatever name it is, I'm really sorry they stopped sending it to me. That really struck me has nothing to do with history, although it does in a way, and that is that I had the book of about the Sidewinder program at China Lake that L.T.E. Thompson was the first technical director at Dahlgren. He's also the first technical director at China Lake. And as far as I am concerned, in that book, it almost ends up with Bonnie Smith at China Lake. And just before I left, Bonnie Smith was technical director. So they really played hand and fist there, the two places.
Yeah, they sure did. Actually, Thompson's an interesting story. We covered him in the first two chapters, and he was the first chief physicist. He came to Dahlgren in 1923, and he essentially set up the scientific program, and he worked by himself. And
he was 2 years old.
Anyway, he came up with a number of innovative ideas, and he was the one responsible mostly for getting the armor and projectile lab established. However, he ran into trouble with Captain Hedrick, and because of his problems with Captain Hedrick, he left Dahlgren in 1942, in January 1942, and went to work for Carl Norden in Indianapolis. And then later he did some private consulting. He was involved in ballistics research for the Manhattan Project, and then he went out to Inyoker in California and became the first technical director at China Lake. And I guess he essentially trained Barney Smith, because what we've found is, in the books and the documents we've recovered, is that Dahlgren lost some of the methodology in running research programs that Thompson had first instilled. And when Barney Smith came east from China Lake, Dahlgren essentially had to relearn Thompson's methodology all over again.
Yeah.
And that's going to be one of the big stories that we're going to cover in Chapter 5.
Something that I think needs to be in there that I ran into in my personnel jacket is the BT test chamber.
What was that?
Listed in the chemical.
Oh, okay.
That it used to be on. I don't know what it was still there when I left. It's on the road from the road that goes through
was it Tisdale Road?
And it used to go across what they call the airport. Then there's a road that turns to the left, goes out to Shellhaven.
Okay, I'm looking at the map right now. I think it's what, Caskey Road? That's not.
I don't know. I wouldn't be able to tell you the name.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you go in the other direction, you go down where the electric power plant is.
Yeah.
That type of thing. Anyway, going to the left, I'm just guessing now, about 3/4 mile out that road was the BC test chamber. And it consisted of, these are just vague because I don't remember that well, a steel sphere, probably 55 feet in diameter, and that was encased in another steel sphere, 65 feet in diameter, with an airlock between the two, the inner shell and the outer shell. And what I have here, and it's dated January 67, is the BC test chamber disaster bill. So that will at least date it.
Yeah, at least to 1967.
Within a few years.
Well, that's very helpful information, because we've only got very sketchy documents on the chemical warfare.
Well, the only reason I'm even familiar with mm-hmm. it is didn't have much to do with it. The only thing we had to do was to furnish a telemetry system that would transmit from the inner chamber to the outside vital functions of the workers inside. And they thought it was going to be a terrible thing to do because, you know, a steel enclosure. But the very first frequency we tried worked fine.
What other stories or anything that you think should be in the book can you think of from anywhere from World War II all the way through 1967?
Well, you know, the problem with that is the fact that a lot of things happened when I was a peon and I didn't have any familiarity with them. I don't know if I mentioned in that excerpt part or not, the Bamberg system is ran by Mr. Gross.
No, you didn't. What was the Bamberg system?
Bamberg system was the checking the bomb drops, and that was all done by telemetry even way back in that day. And Gross was a full-blooded Indian. And that was in the same room where I first worked, where the mm-hmm. Boulanger chronographs were. And they only fired that thing up about roughly once a month. So I don't know, you know, I don't know much about it other than the fact that I hear him communicating with the airplane and the people on the ground that would cross-triangulate drops. And another thing that I think was important at Dahlgren was the Norden bomb site work.
Yeah, actually, we gave it pretty detailed coverage. We gave it about 8 pages worth.
Right.
Yeah, because it was...
Milstead, I think, was the main guy. Not Milstead, I'm sorry. It's, two of his sons worked on the base, in charge of that test.
Oh, Candy? Charles Candy Middlebrook?
Middlebrook.
Yeah, Middlebrook.
I knew it started with an M. I got that part right.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, he has a little memoir that we found in the Library of Congress. And he did quite a bit. He was the first certified bomb site mechanic, and he was responsible for setting up the bomb site school, training mechanics.
I never met him, but his son Carlton was really proud of it.
Well, he's still alive. He still lives down at Dahlgren.
I'll be darned.
And we didn't get to talk to him, but we found his memoir. And
how about Jim Payne?
No, we didn't run across him. Who was he?
Well, I think he'd be important. That's assuming that he's still living, because he started work at Dahlgren in 1935.
Yeah.
And he was like myself. He went to work as a laborer and retired at least at 17.
So
he was in charge of the HERO program.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm definitely interested in the HERO program. Do you know anything about it? Just other...
Only thing I know is the letters order stands for, I think I got them right, hazards to electronic radiation to ordnance.
Because that was a program from the late 1950s. I guess what they found was that the magnetic field that the ships generated by moving through the Earth's magnetic field is, I guess, setting off ordnance.
That was headquartered over in Hangar 2.
Jim Payne's in charge of that. Well, I definitely might want to talk to him. Well, it's a good story, and... if you ever remember anything else, I would definitely encourage you to jot it down, because it really is. It goes into a lot of details about the proving activities. I didn't know about the 5-week training period until I read your, and that's going to be one of the things that I go back and revise our World War II chapter, in which we talk about range operations. So that's definitely a big help.
Well, the other thing, too, is how loose they were on safety.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mr. Carpenter at the shell house. He was a disaster looking for a place to land or whatever.
I was wondering, I guess he did blow himself up.
Yeah, he lost fingers and whatever with a 20-millimeter fooling with in his office.
Yeah, so. Okay, well, I think this will conclude our official interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Dahlgren Centennial podcast. And hopefully you have learned another interesting aspect of what our people accomplished for the Navy and for our nation. We will continue sharing how Dahlgren is one-of-a-kind location where innovation is heralded as the hallmark of each individual. Tune in next week to hear from Harold Goldman, a lifelong resident of the Dahlgren area and the base's legal advisor from 1949 to 1976. Thank you for celebrating this century of innovation with us at Dahlgren.